This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation, one of many we've had over the last 20 years, with Mario Livio, who is astrophysicist for the Hubble Space Telescope, the senior scientist, who's written so many books, The Golden Ratio, so many other wonderful books that I just loved reading and talking about. His latest is called Brilliant Blunders, which I think is a remarkably interesting book because it takes science that we always think that scientists are people who make no mistakes, that everything they do is perfectly pure and right, but that's far from reality. Mario Livio, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
So this is it really is an interesting book. Because we do have the impression that, you know, that all scientific, as you've written, all scientific breakthroughs are these kind of brilliant success stories, and that's all they're about. It's a road to triumph, but it's paved with a lot of trips.
Yeah, lots
stumbles.
That's right. Lots of false starts where you actually need to get back to the beginning. Lots of blind alleys which lead nowhere. Lots of blunders, really, and it's really very different from, you know, a sort of straight march from A to B. So that's one of the main reasons I wanted to write this, to, you know, to correct this impression. And also it's a lesson for all of us.
And when you say a lesson for all of us, I've always been curious reading this book because your own life as an astrophysicist, as a scientist. What about, and I know you'll probably say, my blunders are not brilliant, but.
Most of them are not brilliant, indeed, and certainly not as brilliant as the people who I describe here, because, you know, here I'm talking about luminaries such as Albert Einstein, you know, Charles Darwin, and so on. But yes, of course, I have made my own blunders. One that I, you know, perhaps remember as... again, not brilliant, but something that turned out all right, even though it didn't look that way at the beginning, was that once an astronomer suggested to a found that a certain class of stars were something different than everybody thought. And I came up with a theory to explain that type of phenomenon. But then other astronomers showed that the observations of these first astronomers were actually wrong. So here I was, you know, having this wonderful theory for a phenomenon that maybe didn't exist. Luckily, as it turned out, other astronomers actually found that indeed those original observations were wrong, but there were many other systems that actually did behave that way. So my theory turned out to be relevant after all.
Now, you picked Charles Darwin, Lord Kelvin, or William Thomson, Linus Pauling, Fred Hoyle, and Albert Einstein. An interesting array of people. Well, first, let's talk about why you picked them. And then I have one I want to start with for a very special reason. But why did you pick them?
So the way I picked my scientists was, well, first of all, I wanted them all to be really great scientists. I mean, people that everybody agrees that they were great scientists. Second, I didn't want to go very far back. You see, if you go all the way back to Aristotle, for example, who was a genius, no doubt, everything he said in physics was wrong. So if you go far enough back, you know, it's all blunders, if you like. I didn't want to do that. And third, so I only went to the middle of the 19th century. And third, there is a thread that connects all these five people, which is the thread of evolution. And I mean by that evolution of life on Earth, evolution of the Earth itself, evolution of stars, and evolution of the universe as a whole. So my five people are really major figures in this story of evolution.
Well, when you said that, you said about not going back, you do go back in the book. I mean, one of the things I love about the work you do that you write is that you do go back. You take us through a history of science and scientific thought, whether it's taking us back in some pieces to Antioch and his conversion to Christianity and what that meant for him, but you also take us back to Maimonides and to the great Jewish scientist scholars of the period after him. Why am I blocking? I must say Josephus. It's not right. Give me a second. I just lost my train of thought. Like Spinoza and others, and talk about how they really were critical in changing attitudes about science, because they said, especially the ones I just mentioned, as you wrote about them, said, whatever is in the Bible, if scientific knowledge refutes that, then go with the scientific knowledge.
That's right.
That's a very important, pivotal moment.
That's right. So when I say I didn't want to go back very far, I meant in terms of the protagonists
of the story.
But of course, I do go, you know, to history of thought in many ways. And yes, I mean, you know, Maimonides, you know, had this this idea, which was very important. And, you know, it preceded Galileo by quite a bit in saying those types of things. Indeed, that is the case. Namely, the Bible was not written as a scientific theory. As Galileo has put it, the scriptures were written for our salvation, not as a scientific theory. And he mentioned the fact that not even all the planets are mentioned by name. So it's obvious that it was not written as a scientific theory. It was written as something where, you know, people at the time and till this very day are in awe, you know, in front of this, you know, almost incomprehensible universe. And they expressed in a fantastically poetic way, you know, their awe to that. But they didn't mean to write it as a scientific theory. And so what Galileo said and Maimonides before him is whenever there is a discrepancy between science and the scriptures, you should actually take the science, you know, as describing the science and not what is written in the scriptures, which was not meant literally.
And I, well, so I won't belabor that part, but I was fascinated by that piece of the book myself. And but I'm interested to start with of the five you picked, the one we know least about, which would be Hoyle. Well, I mean, we all know the name of Darwin. We all know Kelvin because of the Kelvin. Linus Pauling, some people know, everybody knows the name Albert Einstein, but Fred Hoyle.
Yeah, Fred Hoyle is very, very well known in the United Kingdom. He's much less known in the U.S. In the United Kingdom, he was not only known as a scientist, but he also had a very important radio program that talked about science and so on. Fred Hoyle was one of the greatest astrophysicists of the 20th century. If we, for example, talk today about the fact that we are stardust, you know, that all the elements in our bodies were formed in the furnaces at the centers of stars, it's Fred Hoyle who gave us, you know, these ideas, and not only ideas, but, you know, turned it into a theory that actually works. So this is that person. It so happens that he's also the person who coined the term Big Bang, even though he always objected to the theory of the Big Bang. That's very amusing that the person who coined the term actually never agreed with that theory.
It was a ridiculing term in his, when he wrote it, right?
Somewhat ridiculing. I mean, people say a little bit more than he actually meant. He actually said it on a radio program, believe it or not, like this one. So he basically, you know, said, you know, there is one theory where everything was created in one big bang. So he wanted to create some sort of a visual picture for his listeners.
So talk about what happened with Fred Hoyle. I mean, because all these men have one thing in common. They're brilliant. They made incredible discoveries. They changed in many ways the course of our scientific thinking, our view of the world and the universe. But all had this kind of stumble, some really reluctant to ever say that they were wrong.
Yes. So like, Fred Hoyle, instead of the Big Bang says, okay, our entire universe started some 13.7 billion years ago. Fred Hoyle wanted the universe to be in a steady state, a universe that is never changing and was always the same and will always be the same. And there is something very elegant about that. Because, for example, you know, we think that the laws of nature don't change. They were always there, you know, and so on. So Fred Hoyle said, look, the universe is the same everywhere. Why not also the same at every time? In fact, this would have been a more elegant theory, if you like. Unfortunately, it turned out not to be correct. Because we found more and more evidence that our universe is evolving. It's changing all the time. It's expanding, you know, and all that. And unfortunately, at older age, he became very stubborn and he just refused to accept that. And he just kept inventing clever ways of how to still make his model work. And because he was extremely smart, he could come up with all kinds of things. But you know, they became increasingly contrived and so on.
he was amazing to me, I guess, in some ways, similar to William Thomson in his reticence to kind of say, oh, I made a mistake, let me rethink this.
That's right. So William Thompson, better known as Lord Kelvin, was another such person that, you know, at his time, he was the greatest physicist of his time. No, he's the guy who is buried next to Isaac Newton. This is how well-known he was. And he was well-known not only as a scientist, but as an engineer and thing, you know, ideas, patents, things, you know, all kinds of things like that and so on.
He lived, you're talking about the 19th, 20th century we're talking about.
We're talking at the latest part of the 19th century.
Right.
But the thing is that you're right. I mean, as he grew older, he started become stubbornly against everything new. Years and decades of being right all the time must have made it very hard for him to admit that on some things he was wrong. So really late in life, he objected to even the most things that you would find amazing. For example, he did not think that people will ever have flying machines, you know, other than balloons and things like that and so on.
But so talk about what he did and what it was, what was his blunder? Why did he stumble into it? And why could he not see that he was wrong?
So he was the first person who did an actual calculation for the age of the Earth. So before him, you know, people used numbers from the Bible to do 6,000 years, 7,000 years, you know, and so on. And he was the first person to say, look, I can use the laws of physics to calculate the age of the Earth. And his idea was simple and brilliant. You know, he said, look, the Earth was formed very hot, and it is losing its heat all the time. And in the same way that if I take a turkey, you know, out of the oven, and I put it in the freezer, and if I then measure basically, you know, the depth of the skin that became cold, you know, from the freezer and so on, I can tell how long has it been in the freezer. Or the same way that, you know, they determine the time of death from the temperature of the corpse and so on. He said, okay, we will measure how the temperature changes with depth in the earth, and from that we'll determine the age. And he determined an age of 100 million years, which is too short because the age of the Earth is about 4.5 billion years.
Just a little short.
Yeah, it's short by about a factor of 50 or so. But it was nevertheless a brilliant calculation because nobody before him knew how to calculate this at all. And he came up with a number. The number was uncomfortable for the geologist. It was uncomfortable for Darwin's theory of evolution. You know, it really was. But he insisted that that's the number. The blunder was that he thought that heat is transported from the center outward just by conduction. You know, like, you know, you put the skillet on the fire and the heat transported through the metal, you know, and so on. When in fact, heat is transported largely by convection, by motion. Like, you know, you put oil on the fire and you have all these currents, you know, that start flowing and so on. And by neglecting that, he made this enormous blunder. He also didn't know originally about radioactivity, which provides some heat to the Earth. But that turned out actually to be not the major problem in his calculation.
And the major problem was?
Was this business of neglecting that was convection.
It.
Yeah, that was it.
But he wouldn't give up.
No, he didn't give up till the very end.
So the other men who you write about did give up, or at least they wrestled with what happened. I think that there's a great quote in here you have of Albert Einstein's. And the quote is, a theorist goes astray in two ways, Einstein said. The devil leads him by the nose and with a false hypothesis. For this, he deserves our pity. Or two, his arguments are erroneous and sloppy. For this, he deserves a beating.
Yes. And Einstein, you know, himself, unfortunately, actually could be accused of both. But, of course, he did so much that was right that, you know, we tend to forget the things that he did that were wrong.
I really wasn't going to jump to Einstein now, but I will, because I will come back and talk to you about this weird connection I had between reading about the other two that I thought was an interesting connection, but with Einstein. And this is because you've written about Einstein in many other books.
Yes, yes. He's certainly one of my heroes.
Yeah. And so what I found interesting was how difficult this was for him to kind of wrestle with what he did. The whole question that you've written about a lot, the cosmological constant.
Yes.
This is the bogeyman for Einstein, but also his brilliant blunder.
This was brilliant. I tell you, you know, I wish I would have made a blunder like that. So look, when Einstein tried to apply his theory of general relativity to the universe as a whole, he thought that the universe was static, that nothing moves. But then he said, but how come everything attracts everything else by gravity? So the whole thing should collapse. It cannot stay static. So he found a clever way by adding this term into his equations, this cosmological constant, which added a repulsive gravity. A gravity that we know is attractive. Everything attracts everything else. He added a repulsive term so that everything would be balanced. It would precisely balance everything. Then, however, Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe is actually expanding. So it's not static. So Einstein said, wait a second. If the universe is expanding, I don't need everything to be in balance because all that gravity would do, it would just slow the expansion down. So he regretted having put that term in, and he took it out of his equation. Then in 1998, we discovered that the expansion of our universe is speeding up. It's accelerating. And what's driving that speeding up? Apparently this term that Einstein took out, put in and then took out. So his blunder, if there ever was any, was in fact in taking this term out. Because had he left it in, he could have predicted that the expansion of the universe should be accelerating.
So, I, by the way, remember we did a program about that in 1998 together.
That's right.
So talk a bit about what you discovered. Why? Because the way you explain it is so logical. Clearly, I'm not an astrophysicist. I'm not a physicist nor a mathematician, so I don't know how the equations went. But what you way you describe it is so logical to think about how the cosmological constant was important to understanding why things slow down, right? Why we're not collapsing on ourselves, why it slowed down. Why was it so hard for Einstein to grab hold of that?
Well, first of all, it's not easy to add terms to Einstein's equations and still keep everything working properly. So this was actually very clever of him to find a way to add a term, to try to keep everything static. But the thing is, the universe is not static, in fact. And in fact, even the solution that he found that was static was really unstable. It's, you know, it's like balancing a pencil on its tip. So, yeah, you can find a spot where it is precisely, in equilibrium, but you shift it a little bit and it falls away. So it was not a good idea at the end just to keep the universe static. Now, the fact that it causes the universe to speed up, to accelerate, that it does very, very well. And that's where we think we are right now. And we're still struggling to understand the meaning of this cosmological constant, but it appears to be there.
What do you think Einstein would be saying today?
Well, if Einstein saw this, I mean, you know, I don't know what he would be saying, because at the time he thought that it was very ugly to add this term to his equations. And if it turned out that it actually is needed, he might have been very pleased, you know, that it actually works. But I'm not sure if he would have changed his mind about whether it's ugly or not. So he might have thought at the end that, okay, maybe it works, but the universe is not so beautiful after all.
There's one of the pieces on that, almost the same page that you wrote about Einstein before we talk about the other two, where you wrote that more than 20% of Einstein's original papers contain mistakes of some sort. In several cases, even though he made the mistakes along the way, the final results were still correct. And you think this is kind of the hallmark for you of great theorists.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Einstein had such intuition. This is why I say I wish I would have made mistakes like that. Einstein had such intuition that even when he made some mathematical errors along the way, somehow the end result turned out to be correct. Because he had such an intuition, and in his mind he saw what the end result must be, that, you know, he made an error one way, he made another error the other way to make the end result come out. Now, most of us cannot do that. We make a mistake, and that's it. It's a mistake. So in that sense, it's hard to learn from Einstein's mistakes in some way, because we cannot really repeat the kind of intuition that he had.
Now, Charles Darwin, like Einstein and Galileo, as you write, they turned the world on its head. Our understanding of its head changed the nature of how we think about our existence.
That's right.
Right? Darwin's blunder. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, Darwin's blunder was fascinating. Because, you see, Darwin came up with a theory of evolution by means of natural selection,
right,
which explains essentially everything about life on Earth. It was amazing. And he did that without knowing any genetics, because nobody knew genetics at the time. So the theory of heredity with which he worked was that the characteristics of the mother and the father get mixed in the offspring, just like you mix paints or gin and tonic. Now, that, we cannot blame him for that, you
right,
know, because he adopted what was known. The part that he didn't get was that if that were the correct theory, natural selection could never have worked. Because, you see, if you have 1,000 butterflies that are white, let's say, and one that is black, and suppose that being black gives you an advantage, Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection would have liked the entire population over many, many generations to turn black. But what would happen with this blending heredity, this mixing of paints? The black butterfly would mate with a white butterfly. They would produce a gray butterfly. The gray butterfly with another white butterfly would produce a paler gray butterfly, and so on. Black would even disappear. It would not even be there. The way that it really works, and Gregor Mendel taught us
right,
that, it's really more like shuffling of decks of cards. You know, if you have a jack, and having a jack is good, like in blackjack, yes, no matter how much you shuffle, you still have the jack. You don't mix it out. It's just there. And that's how genetics really works. And so the color black indeed would stay and can turn the whole population black.
And so Mendel and Darwin never really communicated, did they?
No, they never communicated. Mendel read Darwin. Darwin never read Mendel.
We know that for a fact.
Yes, yes.
So Darwin may have helped Mendel.
Darwin helped Mendel at some level, although the original idea Mendel had by himself from the experiments that he did. But yes, he writes some things that it's very clear that he writes them after he read Darwin. And in fact, he had a copy of Darwin's book and he marked it and so on.
As you wrote about.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that both with Mendel and with Einstein, and Einstein, that they both... I just think about the thing of their brilliance and what they gave us, and they couldn't kind of put their hands around the contradiction, especially with Darwin.
Yeah, Darwin.
Especially.
Yeah, Darwin. Yeah, Darwin, it was pointed out to him that there was this problem, and he was very upset by this. It was pointed out to him by an engineer, Fleming Jenkin, and he understood that there is a problem, and he almost came around to understanding how genetics really works, but he was very weak in mathematics. So at the end, you know, working out probabilities and so on wasn't his strength. So he tried another thing, but that turned out to be a completely wrong theory and so on. He understood that there is a problem, but he just didn't know how to correct it.
Now it's time to talk about somebody that's an interesting connection because of what Linus Pauling got wrong. This two-time Nobel Prize winner, one of my favorite people in history, peace activist, really interesting,
brilliant peace activist,
brilliant human being. But his blunder.
Yeah.
The race for the top.
Yeah. So he came up, he was a victim of his own success. He came up with a correct model for the structure of many proteins. And it was a brilliant model, you know, which was some sort of a helix or a spiral, you know, like this for proteins, which he called the alpha helix. But then he tried to get a model for DNA. And in his model for DNA, he came up with the wrong number of strands. He had three strands instead of two. It was built inside out. He had the bases out instead of in. And the model actually violated some basic rules of chemistry.
Of his own, right,
yeah,
his own world.
He was the greatest chemist at the time,
right?
For heaven's sake, you know. So it was very, very strange. Like I said, you know, he fell victim to his own previous success, because in the case of his model for proteins, he had his original hunch was already correct. And he worked for 13 years to try to prove it correct, and eventually it turned out to be correct. On his model for DNA, he worked on it for a month. And he thought his original hunch was correct and, you know, didn't work very hard to try to prove it. And indeed, it turned out to be completely wrong.
So, Mario, just I'm just curious now, as you put this book together, I know a lot of these tales and stories, not tales because they're true, the stories you wrote about, you knew a lot about them before you started writing. You just fleshed them out with all these ideas. But what did you come to in the end with all this? I mean, there was a reason why you wrote the book, and I'm also curious about that. But what, in the end, might have happened to you once you finished?
Well, one very important thing is the following, really. You know, we teach our students, our children, and so on, that it is wrong to make mistakes.
Right.
That's not true. It is wrong to make sloppy mistakes. It is wrong to be careless and or not thoughtful, you know, in what you do. But it is actually okay to make mistakes when you actually try to think outside the box, when you try to think in unconventional ways, because that sometimes is the way to real discoveries or real breakthroughs. So what I actually want to encourage is this mode of thinking which says, look, you can do incremental creative thinking most of the time, but every now and then take some calculated risks where you are thoughtful, you are careful, but you think a little bit differently and see where that leads you. And yes, occasionally it will be a blunder, but sometimes it can be a really great discovery.
And I just want to say, Mario Livio, as somebody I've known for 20 years now, is a brilliant writer. His books just read so easily, chock full of knowledge. As fun as you, as interesting as you hear him speak, it's even more interesting to read the book, I think, because the books are just so full of everything that we couldn't cover. The book is Brilliant Blunders, From Darwin to Einstein, Colossal Mistakes by Great Scientists That Changed Our Understanding of Life and the Universe. Mario Livio, this is a pleasure to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.